We're taking it step by step with stock market investing here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. More Americans than ever are invested in the stock market. A little over 50% of Americans own some form of stock. And there's good news in the rising popularity of index and mutual funds that make investing easier and safer since you spread the risk across a lot of securities. But still, there is risk involved and still there is tricky jargon, especially if you don't come from an economics background. And then you need the cash to buy the stock in the first place. Are you someone who's always avoided investing because you never felt ready? What's held you back? What scares you most about the market? 800-642-1234. Join in throughout the hour. Erin Lowry is a personal finance expert and author of the new book, Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money. It's her second book in the Broke Millennial series, and she founded the website BrokeMillennial.com. Erin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your values on personal finance, they really stem from your upbringing and your father specifically. How did he set you on a path for entering the market at a younger age? What did he teach you?
Well, I don't want to discredit my mom either. Both of them really were a united front, if you will, when it came to money. And I would say for me, a big part of it is that I lived in a household where we were very comfortable talking about money growing up. But that didn't necessarily translate to me feeling like a confident investor. Just because I understood cash flow and how to start saving at a young age doesn't necessarily mean I was ready to throw money. And what's interesting is that for me, the very first time I even considered investing, I didn't recognize it as investing. And the way I open up my second book is talking to my dad about the fact I had interned over the summer. And surprisingly, this was back in 2010, it ended up being a paid internship. So I had extra money. And I had heard over the summer that, hey, if you have taxable income, you can put it in something called a Roth IRA. And I said that to my dad. And he goes, yeah, probably a good idea for you to start investing. And I went, well, I mean, I'm not ready to actually start investing yet. And he said, well, putting money into an IRA is investing. And that was one of the first very small steps. And then he went on to tell me a story about how cyclical the stock market is. And part of that actually was him sharing my family's losses in 2008 and how my parents just hung on and actually kept putting money in and it came back around. And that very quick small story really repositioned the way I thought about the stock market, made it much less intimidating and scary. And I'm somebody who generally in life is a bit of a rule follower and a goody-goody. So my risk tolerance in the beginning wasn't exactly high, but it is now.
Oh, so going back to the Great Recession, your family didn't pull money out of the stock market at that point. Your family was actually investing more, buying more when the market had tanked.
Exactly, which sounds so counterintuitive to a lot of folks, but my dad used that as an opportunity to explain how if you have a well-diversified long-term plan on your investments, and this wasn't money that they needed in the short term, the better strategy is to just hang on. And in fact, technically, things are on sale when you're going through a dip or, in that case, a crash.
You target millennials for your advice, but investing is really something that everyone can do better, regardless of what generation you're in. What is your advice to the older generations?
To get started if you haven't yet. And I think that a lot of it too is technology has changed the game in so many ways. And that is one thing that both millennials, Gen Z, and even younger Gen Xers, we really have gotten to take advantage of this in a completely different way. It used to be that you needed a set amount of money before you could even walk into either a brokerage firm or go speak to a wealth management advisor.
Like $3,000.
Exactly. And that's a lot of money to a lot of people. And I mean, I couldn't have started with a lump sum of $3,000. So it has totally changed. And I think that not everyone recognizes that fact and that there are very safe options to be investing either yourself or with an online brokerage or in some case with micro investing apps.
We're talking with Erin Lowry. She is a personal finance expert and author of the book, Broke Millennial Takes on Investing. Bring on your questions about investing, any and all, 800-642-1234. Are you someone who's always avoided investing because you never felt you were ready? What's held you back? Or did you start investing at an early age? How did you get started? Tell us your story. Ask your questions. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Erin, what keeps people back? What keeps people from investing in the stock market?
Oh, I wish that was an easy answer to the question. There's a lot of different reasons, but I really feel a big one is the intimidation factor. And part of that is the language that gets used. Truthfully, it is like learning a second language. And I don't want to tinfoil hat this, but to a degree, it almost feels as if they're doing that deliberately. Like, hey, it's so confusing. You need to hire somebody that's expensive to help you. And you don't, but you do have to take the time to learn what different terms mean in order to feel confident and competent.
401k like retirement funds are one way that people get in on the markets early on. How have you seen 401ks as a gateway for people to get access to the stock market?
I love this question because honestly, so many people do not think of themselves as investors if they have a 401k or a 403b or an IRA. And you are. And to me, I think it's because we use the wrong language. We say save for retirement when really you're investing for retirement. And I really hope that that small language shift for a lot of people can make them feel a bit more confident. And it's much easier to get started with a 401k because one, you might have that incentive of somebody else giving you money to put into the account. So you feel more encouraged to get started.
Oh, like an employer match.
Absolutely. That employer match, not for everyone, is it's not always an incentive, but it can be because there is essentially free money on the table. But I would also say, too, then there are programs, depending on your employer and depending on which brokerage they use, that you can call someone up. There's a little bit more handholding involved, or you can talk to other people at work, and it doesn't feel like such an intimidating thing to do because it's something everyone's kind of going through.
Well, let's bring in Lisa now in Madison with a question. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning. My question is, my son is 16 years old. He had his first job this last summer, and I'm wondering if he should open a Roth IRA, if he's old enough to do that. And if he does do that, what effect will that have on his applying for financial aid for college?
That is a great question. And honestly, I don't know all of the nuances to it. I would say typically money that's in retirement accounts, from my understanding, do not count when it comes to FAFSA. And he should be able to put, because he has taxable income, he should be able to put money into a Roth IRA. You may need to be the custodian until he's 18 years old, but taxable income usually means you can put money into a Roth IRA.
Lisa, thanks so much for the question. Do you find that your son is thinking about investing, or does he have questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Lisa is not there. You know, Erin, the richest 10% control more than 80% of the total value of stocks. What do you make of that finding?
You know, I think that that's something that can be used to feel discouraged, but I like to reposition things into a positive a lot of times, especially when it comes to investing. And this sounds like such a silly way to say it, but I kind of want to say, get yours, get into the game. Don't just cede total control.
We're on a personal finance journey, learning how to pick stocks, improve our financial literacy. Erin Lowry is author of Broke Millennial Takes on Investing. Have you recently started investing in the stock market? What was the biggest hurdle you had to start an investment portfolio? And now that you invest, how often do you check on your portfolio? Are you okay with weathering these ups and downs? Join in with your strategy, your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this hours of personal finance questions and stories with you in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about investing in the stock market. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And like author Erin Lowry, I started investing in my 20s. I scraped together just enough cash to get into a mutual fund. And knowing nothing about brokerage firms, I bought into a mutual fund where some of my fellow grad school alums went to work at Vanguard in Valley Forge, PA. just down the road from Philly. They have a sprawling campus headquarters, and I had been inside once or twice. Very dark suits, let me tell you. And I was flying blind on investing. We're learning how to make more thoughtful decisions that are not based on dark tailored suits and getting your questions answered through the hour, 800-642-1234. Are you trying to enter the stock market? What holds you back from stocks? What questions do you have about apps that are out there like Robinhood and Stash and Stockpile? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron Lowry's new book is called Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money. And she stays with us. Let's go to DR Keys in Milwaukee. Hi, DR Keys.
Hi, Kay. How are you?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to make a comment. I appreciate this broadcast and this conversation that you're having. I'm 29, and I've been investing for several years now. I had a 403B through my job, and I managed that just because I realized a lot of people don't know where their money's actually going to. And then I've used apps like Robinhood, which is cool because they don't charge you to actually trade. And then Acorns is another app that I really like because it rounds up your spare change and invests that for you as well.
Wow. So Robinhood and Acorn. Aaron, what do we know about these apps and this type of technology?
So I actually mentioned both of those in my book, and good for you for getting started at such a young age and really taking control of your investing life. I love hearing that. Microinvesting apps are a great way for people to get started. But one of the things I always like to point out when we talk about them is, as you just mentioned, the, you know, round up, invest your spare change. It's a good, and I hate to use the word gimmick, but you need to do more than that, which you certainly are. But other people need to make sure that when they get started with a micro investing app, even if the fee to use the platform is as small as something like a dollar a month, that actually really can add up over time if you're not putting enough money into the market through the app. A rule of thumb that I like to use is to be putting in at least $25 to $50 per month. It'd be great if you can do more, but if that's just the small way you can get started, that's wonderful. But you want to be doing more than $5, otherwise that fee is really going to eat away at all of your returns.
And these apps, how easy is it to make that monthly contribution or that regular contribution when you do have that spare change?
They really have made it quite simple, and there's different alternatives. So Acorns, which has really pioneered the roundup and invest your spare change, they also encourage you to automate putting money away. So it's not exclusively that you're investing your spare change. And that's what I want people to do, is to do both. Round up when you make a purchase, and then also be maybe putting $25, $50 a month or more away. And the other thing I love about pretty much all of the micro investing apps is that they have an educational platform baked into them. So not only are they fairly easy to use and intuitive when you're setting up, and they ask you questions to help you set your goals, which then dictates how you're going to be picking your investments, they also have blogs and emails that they send out to you when the market's going through a little bit of a hiccup or whatever it is, to make sure that you're starting to get more educated and feel confident as an investor.
Well, DR Keys, thanks so much for your strategy. Aaron, you have a checklist to help people figure out whether they're ready to start investing. What should people be assessing in their own personal finance before they jump in?
And one thing I always like to bring up before I jump into the checklist is that included in this checklist is investing for retirement. So really, when we're talking through this, it's for when you're considering investing outside of retirement into a taxable account. But the very first thing, and I alluded to it when I was talking about those micro investing apps, is that you have to set your financial goals. You really can't pick your investments. You can't decide how the risk tolerance you're going to put on it, the time horizon you're going to have, which is the amount of time until you need access to your money, until you know why you're investing. So step one, it sounds simple, but it can be complicated, is setting your financial goals. Then you need to master your cash flow, which is a fancy way of saying budget. But until you have total control over how much is coming in and how much is going out, you're really not quite ready to be investing. And I also want to make sure that you have that emergency savings fund. At the top of the hour, I mentioned the story about how my parents were able to weather 2008 and not have to pull money out of the market. And part of that is because they had a really healthy emergency reserve. They didn't have to go and tap that money. And so that's certainly something you want to consider before you start investing. And another big one is make sure that you pay off consumer debt, especially those high interest credit cards. We're looking at between 15 all the way up to about 30% APR on those bad boys. And frankly, you're not going to see those kind of returns on average in the market. Now, one thing I get asked a ton is about student loans.
Mm-hmm. And we can go there in a moment. But what if you have, say, a mortgage or a car payment? Should you still be investing?
And that's a great question. I would honestly lump those into the student loan category if it's a low interest rate. And especially with a mortgage, mortgages usually have a fairly competitive and low interest rate compared to, you know, the crushing feeling of a 15 plus APR on your credit cards. So it certainly can make sense for you to be investing while paying down your mortgage.
Talking with Erin Lowry, she's a personal finance expert. Her book is called Broke Millennial: Takes on Investing. You can join in with your questions, your stories about getting into the stock market. 800-642-1234. What was the biggest hurdle for you to become an investor? What scares you the most about the stock market? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Ibrahim in Madison. Hi, Ibrahim.
Hi.
What's your question?
So I'm generally thinking about like joining or like investing, but I just had like a couple like, you know, questions or like I need advice on. Like what would be like the general, you know, tips on how to start investing or what to look out for?
And when you say how to start, what to look out for, are you thinking about what funds or how to decide on like a brokerage firm or how much money you should scrape together? Where are you starting from, Ibrahim?
Like based on the money, like how much money should I start with or and like what funds should I think about basically?
Yeah, yeah. Erin, where should Ibrahim start?
Well, one thing is making sure you have that checklist all completed and making sure you have those emergency reserves. And after you've done that, you fortunately don't have to have a huge lump sum in order to get started. But I never prescriptively tell people the funds that they should start investing in because, frankly, I don't know you. I don't know your goals. I don't know when you want access to this money. And I don't know your risk tolerance. So it really does a disservice for me to just prescriptively try to give investors. But I would certainly look around at options like index funds and ETFs to see what might fit your overall investment goals. They typically have lower expense ratios, which means lower fees, and you know they get you easily diversified, so you're not doing individual stock picking to get yourself into the market.
And explain what you mean there by ETFs and these lower cost funds that spread out the risk.
So one way that I actually had someone explain it to me that I really liked is that if you think about you bought a house, kind of like buying a stock, you just own one house in the neighborhood. But when you buy an ETF or an index fund, it's like you own the entire neighborhood. So an ETF, which is an exchange traded fund, and then an index fund is a bundle of stocks. So you're owning a small piece of a lot of different companies. And so that means that you're already spreading out your risk because you're not just investing in one particular company that does one certain thing.
So, you know, Erin, you've asked a bunch of experts for beginner investing tips, and they talked about asset allocation and diversification. Some words there that could use some explaining. Can you break that down?
The one that I love to explain with asset allocation is that first you have to understand what an asset is, and it's a grouping of similar investments. And that kind of jargon still might not necessarily mean something to you. But if you think about it, like beer is your asset class, and then the grouping of similar investments are your ales, your IPAs, your lagers, your stouts. And that's how we think about it with asset allocation or with assets in the market. You have stocks, you have bonds, you have cash and cash equivalent, you might have real estate. Those are typical asset classes. Now, when it comes to asset allocation, that is just the percentage of your investment that you're putting into each of these different asset classes. So if you're at maybe a 70-30 split, maybe you're at 70% stocks and 30% bonds, and that's your asset allocation. And that needs to change over time as you get closer to wanting access to that money, because typically we want to go from a bit more aggressive when we've got a long ways to go to more conservative when you're going to need access to that money soon so that there's not as much risk. Now, diversification can be easily summed up with the cliche, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And essentially, you just want to make sure that your investments are protected by not putting your money in one company that does one thing. It's called a sector of the stock market, like technology. You don't want to put all of your money in one company that is in tech. You want to have some in tech, some in transportation, some in healthcare, some in utilities. So if just tech goes through a bad month, it doesn't decimate your portfolio.
We're talking about investment approaches and theories and making disciplined decisions with an investment portfolio through the stages in life. Aaron Lowry's new book is Broke Millennial Takes on Investing. Are you thinking about pulling out some of your retirement money out early? What questions do you have about investing over the long term? Do you automatically invest a little each month in the spirit of dollar cost averaging? How have you seen your portfolio grow this way through the decades? What do you teach your kids about the stock market? 800-642-1234. Coming up after the news, we talk about strategies for balancing a portfolio, pulling out money earlier than expected. That's coming up after a news update. Stay with us here in the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about investing in the stock market and managing an investment portfolio through all stages of life. You're with us for an hour-long personal finance conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Finance author Aaron Lowry recalls growing up in a family that lived well below its means. She writes how she was incredibly fortunate to have grown up with a blueprint for how to become a millionaire and to have received the benefits that a financially stable family affords. She says they didn't struggle to cover basic needs, her parents didn't fight about money, and there is privilege in this. But Erin says she didn't fill out a loan application at the bank of mom and dad. She attended a smaller, less known college that gave her scholarships to come out debt-free on the other end. So what is your story about starting out and developing an investing ethic? Do you have a 401k type retirement investment? Do you check on your portfolio? 800-642-1234. The book is called Broke Millennials. Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, and Aaron Lowry stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Angela joining us from Waukesha. Angela, hi.
Hi.
What's your question?
So my question is investing in the stock market versus investing in real estate properties. We've had the privilege of being able to have both a property, and we have a Roth for retirement, but we're kind of coming along lines of, do we get another property versus do you put more in the stock market? And really, in the end, what gives you a better return? I realize that there's risk for both, but is one considered to have a better return on its money versus the other?
And when you buy, say, property, is this property that you're renting out? Is this property
correct?
That, okay, okay.
Yeah, we had bought, when we first got married, a condo at the height of the, you know, housing market before it, you know, hit the bubble. And so we couldn't afford the loss on it, but we were fortunate that we had saved enough that we were able to rent it out while buying another property.
Ah.
So we, you know, have both, and now we're kind of at a point of, you know, do we buy another property as an investment, or do we take that money and invest it in the stock market? And, you know, what long-term is a better investment, you know, if you're able to do that?
Angela, thanks for the question. Aaron, what are your thoughts here as you look, you know, going down the property path or more traditional investing in the stock market?
So, personally, I see the benefits both ways, and it's interesting. This is a pretty common debate in the personal finance nerd circles. I err on the side of preferring the stock market, and a big part of that is because I don't particularly want to have to deal with tenants. Now, I know you can hire property managers and you can outsource a lot of that, but part of it is your risk tolerance. How easy would it actually be to sell and offload the house? How easy is it to find quality tenants? Now, the perk, of course, of having rental properties and having multiple is the cash flow that you have coming in, and that hopefully eventually also you can sell off the property and you get a nice windfall that way. In terms of which offers better returns, I mean, it really just depends. It depends on where you are, where your investment properties are, what you're investing in when it comes to the stock market. But I would go back to that very original question that I set up of when you're deciding whether or not the stock market is right, and think about what your goals are.
as a couple? What are your goals for the future? Are you just looking for the cash flow from an investment property? Do you want to be investing in the stock market for a particular time when you can more easily cash out than having to sell a property? There's a lot to think through, and unfortunately, it's not a cut and dry answer.
Oh, Angela, thanks for the question, though. And Aaron, you know, some of that money, though, Angela has could be invested in the stock market, in real estate, like in those real estate investment trusts and diversifying that way.
Absolutely. You could invest in a REIT. So that's kind of the best of both worlds. You're investing both through the market and in real estate in that particular sector, that particular asset class of the stock market.
Well, let's bring in Jenny now in Rice Lake. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
What's your question?
So my son is 24 years old. He got out of college debt free. His company has a 401k and they match up to 5%. He's investing 20%, just automatically taken out of his check. And he's doing 10% Roth and 10% traditional. And I'm wondering if there are other things he could be doing.
Wow. So that's a really aggressive strategy there, Jenny, and to come out of college debt-free. That's a really great position, Aaron. Do you see it?
Yes, absolutely. Good for him. That is awesome that he's already that far ahead. In terms of could he be doing more? Well, I mean, the first thing he can do if he wants is, and if he's not already, is maxing out the 401k. It's $19,000 right now in 2019 that you can put away. And then once he maxes out, if he's got more money to spare, he could just go and look into investing in either index funds, ETFs, be investing in the market in a taxable account outside of retirement. But the other thing, too, is what are the shorter term goals? Maybe he wants to be saving up cash for a bigger purchase, like going back to the last call. Maybe he wants to buy a home, or if he already does own a home, maybe he wants an investment property.
Jenny, does he have some long term goals that he's shared with you?
Not really at this point. He does have about $12,000 saved, and that's what we've talked about is saving then for a down payment on a house.
And that could also be an emergency fund as well
until that
down payment happens. Aaron, $12,000 in cash reserves there in case something happens or in saving for that down payment. Is that a good strategy?
That is, and that's a very healthy emergency savings fund. Again, I don't know your son's particulars on his day-to-day financial life, but $12,000 is certainly a great emergency fund. And then I would say on top of that, if he's able to be putting money away to save for a down payment on a house, you don't want to cash out your emergency fund for the down payment. You want to make sure you still have both, especially since sometimes Murphy's Law comes around and you buy that house, something goes wrong immediately. So you want to make sure you still have that emergency cash reserve.
Talking with Erin Lowry, she's a personal finance expert. Her book is Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money. What do you want to know about picking stocks and your portfolio? Not sure if investing is the right decision for you? What are you currently weighing? What questions do you have? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron, you talk about the importance of rebalancing your investments. So you have, you know, half of your money in stocks, half in bonds. Why do you need to keep these investments stable and checking in on them to make sure your asset mix is in the right balance?
I think sometimes it's easy for us to just kind of set it and forget it, especially when it comes to something like investing. But you picked that asset allocation for a reason. So if it's a 50-50 split, 70-30, 80-20, whatever it is, you made that decision because it aligned with your financial goals and when you wanted access to your money. But what happens is the market performs and perhaps puts your portfolio out of whack. Maybe your stocks do really well this year, or maybe they don't. But let's say hypothetically that they do, and you were at 80-20, and now all of a sudden you're at 90-10. Well, you need to sell off 10% of the stocks and rebalance it to buy up some more bonds or whatever it is that you have as your more conservative investment. And that's something that if you don't pay attention, it's really easy to let those things get out of whack, which means that if something happens and you need access to your money, you may be invested in a way that no longer actually does align with your financial goals and when you needed access to that money.
How often should you be checking your portfolio?
This is a great question, and I asked every single expert I interviewed for the book. And I would say on average, the response is once per year. And that especially if you get a little bit nervous, if you get a little bit maybe trigger happy with selling when the market is going through a dip, that's a good time to not be looking. One of the women I actually interviewed who worked for Vanguard, as you mentioned earlier, so she works as a professional in the stock market. And in 2008, she went the whole year without looking at her portfolio because she knew she wasn't going to like what she saw. She kept investing. She knew she had a solid strategy and that she shouldn't sell anything. So she just avoided looking. And I really thought that that story perfectly summed up. Honestly, even when you're an expert in the field and this is your day job, it's still an emotional experience, which is why oftentimes checking in once a year is enough for a lot of people. But if you want to be a little bit more hands-on, perhaps once a quarter. And if you can stomach it, once a month is fine.
Dan in Central Wisconsin is joining us now. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I currently have a financial advisor. And obviously, I pay fees to this financial advisor. Part of it is peace of mind, I feel like. But I'm curious to know your suggestions on when you would have a financial advisor, when you wouldn't, and then how long in hours would it take for somebody to learn about ETFs or index funds to be able to be successful on their own?
Great question, Dan. Aaron, what do you think about someone in the middle there managing your portfolio?
I am not anti-advisor at all. I certainly see the value. I just want to make sure that no matter what platform you're using, if you're using a person, if you're using a robo-advisor, if you're using an app, if you're just a do-it-yourself through a discount brokerage, that you make sure that the fee that you are paying is bringing you value. And the value isn't necessarily exclusively the return, although that should count for a lot. But it also needs to be maybe working with a person is best for you because you know that you get very nervous if the market is reacting and you need somebody else who's another set of eyes, who's going to hold you accountable, who's not going to let you just sell everything off in a panic. And that then certainly is bringing a huge value set to you. Maybe this is not something that you have any interest in really learning about, but you know it's important, so you're essentially outsourcing it. And you're just willing to pay a little bit more for that. In terms of the amount of time that it takes to put yourself in an educational space, I would also think of it as a progression. You can educate yourself fairly simply between books and blogs and podcasts and radio shows and TV shows about some very bare minimum basics to just put some money in the market. But you can then keep growing and keep learning and then build your portfolio from there. So I would say it doesn't take a lot just to learn enough to get started, but it should be an evolving process, especially if you're going to be a do-it-yourself investor.
Aaron Lowry, our guide here as we look at the market and investing. Still time for your questions, your story about how you got your start in investing, 800-642-1234. What stage of life are you in, and how do you think about the stock market today? As you look back, do you wish you could change something about how you approached your finances and the way you view the stock market? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back with Aaron in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour talking about investing in the stock market and how to build a portfolio with an eye on the long game, right? Through all stages of life. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The National Institute on Retirement Security says two-thirds of millennials in the U.S. have nothing saved for retirement. Roughly half of Americans are not in the stock market at all. So what tips did you learn early on that have stuck with you in adulthood and are a pillar of your personal finance approach today? Share your story, share your tips, 800-642-1234. Aaron Lowry's new book is called Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money, and she stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Clint is joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Clint.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I've been investing in my 401k for the past 20 years, and I've seen over the last, I want to say, probably 8 to 10 years, target retirement funds being a big investment tool and trying to, I guess, simplify the way a person can invest. I was hoping we can get some insight on, one, what are the pros of that? And then what are some of the pitfalls that we've experienced over the last decade investing in those types of investments?
Clint, thanks for the question. These target funds saying, you know, you have your eye on retiring in, say, you know, 2040 or something. So it's going to be a 2040 target fund. Is that how it works, Aaron?
That's right. So it's tied to your estimated retirement year. Now, honestly, they're usually in increments of five. So if you're planning to retire in 2042, then you might either want to go to 2040 or 2045. And I'll also throw out a couple other names that they get referred to as, which is life cycle funds and all-in-one funds. So you might also hear those terms. Now, in terms of the pros, the thing that I like about them is that I have heard so many horror stories, especially when researching for my book, about people who thought they were investing and were putting money into a 401k, and it was actually just sitting in cash. So at about 60, they call up and ask how much money is in there. And there's, you know, possibly $250,000, but it should have been $1 million+. And that's because it was never actually invested. It was just sitting in cash. And the target date fund really takes a lot of the pain point out of kind of going back to the earlier call about how you know that you're ready to get started and that you can pick investments yourself. Well, I can tell you, I was 22 years old when I tried to set up my first 401k. And I just remember looking at all the different options I had for investments and panicked and closed the browser and walked away. And that's a lot of people's first reaction. So with a target date fund, it makes sure that you are invested in the market, and that over the years, you will go from more aggressive to more moderate to more conservative as you get closer to retirement. So your money is actually invested. That's definitely the big pro. Now, the con is that the fees tend to be higher. So if you did it yourself and build it yourself, you could probably build a portfolio with lower fees. Every dollar that you spend in fees today is a dollar less that's growing and compounding for future you. The other downside of a target date fund is that it's a one-size-fits-all solution to something that should be specifically tailored and curated to you personally. So you're invested in something that doesn't necessarily know your exact goals, that doesn't know your exact risk tolerance. And one of the things that you can do is you can kind of hybrid in the beginning if you don't know a ton about investing, and maybe that's a great option just to make sure that your money is invested in your 401k, go with a target date fund. And then as you get more educated and more confident, or perhaps you hire somebody to help you with your finances, then you can move it out of the target date fund and build your own specific portfolio tailored to you. There's no rule that says it has to stay in the target date fund until the end.
Appreciate the question, Clint. Let's bring in Eric now in Menominee Falls. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Kate. I'm just curious if it's better for me to aggressively pay down like the $20,000 in student loan debt that I have at like about a 6% interest rate, or if I should be still investing for retirement and, you know, playing the stock market, but like taking away from paying down that debt.
Ooh, and Eric said playing the stock market. So he understands that there's ups and downs and there's risk involved. But what do you think there, Aaron?
There's an entire chapter of my book dedicated to the should I be investing when paying off student loans question, because it's the most prevalent for so many people. And the cutoff answer for a lot of experts I interviewed was 5%. Now, there's an exception to this rule. Now, first, let me explain the 5%. If your interest rate on your student loan is 5% or higher, they recommend that you focus on paying down your student loans, because odds are your average return in the market, people say between 6 and 7, but they want to be a bit more conservative and no one regrets paying off debt. However, all of them will also say, if you have access to a retirement account, especially if you have an employer match, at least take advantage of the employer match and then put everything extra in going towards paying off your student loans. So if your employer matches you at, let's say, 5%, be putting at least 5% into your 401k so you still get that extra money. And now you're actually putting 10% into your retirement account. And then all your extra money can go towards getting rid of those student loans. But at 6%, I would probably hold on dabbling in the market in a taxable account outside of retirement, but I wouldn't completely stop putting money away for retirement.
Eric, thanks so much. And, you know, Aaron, you have a multiply by 25 rule intended to help people figure out how to save for their retirement. Can you tell us about the multiply by 25?
To be honest, I think it really kind of depends on what your goals are with investing. But I'm going to be honest at this time in the morning off the top of my head, I'm not remembering what that rule is. There are certain rules that I would have wrote this book over a year ago that I'm actually going to look up. Well, really quickly,
let's talk a little bit about dollar cost averaging, and you know, being pretty vigilant that you're investing each month at the same time, the same place. It just happens because life happens really fast, and we can forget about we have to check in with personal finance and do the actual investing. What do you think about dollar cost averaging?
I think it can be a great tool. A lot of people will debate whether or not it's better than putting in lump sums into the market. Frankly, whatever gets you investing is really what I care about. To some people, they think it makes more sense to be putting money in smaller increments over the year, because the theory with dollar cost averaging be at some points the market is higher, at some points the market is lower, but then you're kind of averaging out to getting a better deal than if you just dump it in a lump sum. You might be hitting the market at a high note and not getting the best bang for your buck than if it had dipped a little bit, you would have gotten a little bit more value. The thing that's nice in general just about dollar cost averaging is that you know you're consistently putting money away as opposed to saving up a lump sum and then maybe being tempted to spend that lump sum on something else. So you want to make sure that you're actually sticking to putting money away and investing it every single month, especially when we're thinking about retirement.
Well, Charles from Mount Horeb, he called in to say investing should be taught as early as possible, in middle school even. Mary and Madison also called to ask, how can parents help or start investments for kids when they're still young? What do you think?
Well, you could open an account for them. There's different ways to be thinking about this. There's plans like a 529 plan that is earmarked specifically for educational expenses, but it still could be invested. There's ways that you could open a custodial account for them. You mentioned in the very beginning in a microinvesting app called Stockpile, which is fractional shares, and you actually can gift shares to kids. So that could be something that goes into their stockings. But you could also just open up an account, and you could be the custodian of it until they're 18 years old and then hand it over if you prefer to do it that way. And I do want to go back, because I looked it up to make sure that I was saying it properly, the multiply by 25 rule. And really, it's a way for you to decide how much money you'll need in retirement. And it kind of ties into the 4% withdrawal rule in order to determine how much you need to have set aside. And the idea is that you multiply by 25 the amount of money per year you think you'll need in retirement. So if you need $40,000 a year, by 25, you need $1 million in your retirement account. And I also want to commend the person who said we should start teaching investing as early as possible. I agree. And the easiest way to kind of introduce this concept is by talking about compound interest and how it can work for you in investing and it works against you in debt. And I think that's just such a critical thing to get people to understand.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Aaron Lowry is a personal finance expert. Her book is called Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money. And her website is brokemillennial.com. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.